Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Episode number 351 of We Are Podcast. My name is Ronsley, and I'm coming to you again from my little house here in Goa, writing my second book, Amplify AI. And I want to talk about it because the fact that it is some days, you know, the book doesn't actually come out. So these are little tricks that I'm trying to actually get it to come out. So today I'm talking with Dan Illick. And we had a Dan last week. I think you should go check out that episode. It's a great one with Daniel Mangena. But Dan Illick, this time, he is the host of a Rational Fear podcast. He's a comedian, and we talk some deep things about the Rational Fear podcast, the evolution, but also about the voice in Australia and how important it is for having a voice or giving a voice or using your voice. It's a very, very deep episode because we talk about the origins and current people of Australia. And it's such a huge topic, in fact. And for all of us that are trying to put out our voice and put out our creation, we want to kind of put that element of why we are in business, what impact are we trying to make? What is our bigger mission? What is at play here? And that is part of us using our voice and making it for the good. So enjoy this episode.
You can't find your voice if you don't use it. This is We Are Podcast, formerly called Should I Start a Podcast? A podcast for podcasters who want a podcast that grows their business and brand. How many times can we say podcast in a sentence? Here's your host, Ronsley. He has interviewed more than 1,500 people, has been listened to over 5 million times in 133 countries. He has helped create over 1,100 podcasts for businesses, brands, and personalities. He's been doing this for more than a decade. Get ready to take notes. Enjoy the show.
Dan, welcome to the show. This has been, I feel like, a long time because we've been connected on LinkedIn for a little while and I'm a follower, right? I've seen a lot of your work and I was very impressed with the work you've done through the Vote Yes movement. But I'd love to hear about your podcasting journey first. So when you think about you first starting the podcast, what are the things that come to mind and how did you get that going? Is this the first version of the podcast or did you have multiple versions before this came around?
I think, like many people who have a podcast, it's an ongoing experiment. You know, Irrational Fear has been going for 10 years and it first started off as a live to-air radio show, live from a pub in Sydney in King's Cross. It was part of the band room at the time was called the FBI Socials and I was a broadcasting FBI for years. And so when it came to 2012 and I'd done a couple of TV shows, all I wanted to do next was like a daily show kind of show. And I thought the best way to do that would be to kind of pilot it on stage. We turned it into like an event and DJ Tom Loud, who does Hot Dub Time Machine, he's like a superstar worldwide DJ right now. I think he's like the highest grossing dance music act in Australia and the world, kind of analyzing the contemporary anxiety of the world. So yeah, it was pretty wild. Those first few shows, we aimed to do them once a month at the FBI Social. And when they were streaming, not only were they broadcasting live on FBI, we then took the audio and turned it into a podcast. So if you go back to those very early days, you'll hear essentially a live comedy show from 2012, time capsule. So yeah, it was pretty cool. And when you're driving around and you turned on FBI and you heard the show, you'd be like, wow, that is live. I'm going to drive to King's Cross. And people would drive to King's Cross to come to the pub to watch us. And no matter like how kind of far we were through an episode, like halfway through or whatever, the audience kind of grew and grew. It was this fun, kind of fun element. And then so for the last 4 years, we've really been going at it hard by trying to do it as weekly as often as possible. So been going weekly. We've got about 8,000 to 10,000 listeners. So not a huge audience. And I know we're not shameless. I'm not Abby Chatfield here, but we definitely have a fun community full of people who are engaged in the world, focused on climate, and people who like to get stuff done, people who are really keen, have a keen interest in civics and democracy and climate and all the issues that go around with that. And great support from the comedy fraternity who love coming on it to not only promote their work, but also, you know, have a place to say something about the world.
Yeah. I mean, so it was always called A Rational Fear. And by the way, congratulations on all the awards. It's actually a huge testament to the work that you've done before you became a podcaster and how you've developed. I think the listenership and the number of listeners is just a vanity metric. It is actually how much you enjoy. And I can tell how much you're enjoying doing it, right? Was it always called A Rational Fear? And why did you name it that?
A Rational Fear, yeah. So the name came from the idea that things in the media, it tries to make you scared of all sorts of things. And fear, by its nature, is irrational. And the only thing in the media that people weren't talking about back in 2012 was climate change. And so I wanted to do a show mixing climate change and comedy and called A Rational Fear. And I thought A Rational Fear was a nice pun, kind of semi-pun on A Current Affair. And so if you think A Current Affair and A Rational Fear kind of sound the same, that's the reason. In fact, in our second or third episode, I think we had one of the hosts of A Current Affair join us on stage and to kind of do comedy with us. So that was really fun. Yeah.
Yeah. You've been giving a voice to a lot of things. Let's talk about climate change because it's the front and center. It's something that you feel very strongly about, and that's the reason why you started A Rational Fear. And what made you decide that that was something that you wanted to give a voice to? Do you remember a moment where you decided, okay, this is something I want to give a voice to?
It just seemed crazy. There was this huge disconnect, right, between what our government was doing and what the scientists were saying. And I've thought that for a long time. You know, I've worked in media and kind of progressive comms for a long time. And it was just like, wow, that is so bizarre. And I think one of the most astounding thing was when Tony Abbott got into power about 11 years ago, the first thing he did was shut down the Department of Climate Change. Literally shut down the whole department. Said, we don't need that. It doesn't exist. And so the response to that was a whole bunch of prominent climate scientists got together. They created the Climate Council, which has been going about the same time as us, been going for about 10 years. So that was a bit of a moment for me where I was like, yeah, far out. The culture wars are so insidious, like to the point where real data isn't being listened to, real facts are being ignored and to the detriment of everyone. And that made me furious. So I thought I would make this space where we could kind of talk about it. And that was the thing for me. And I guess the other thing, a few years prior to that, I made a sketch on a TV show called Hungry Beast called I'm a Climate Scientist, where I got a whole bunch of climate scientists together to rap about being climate scientists because everyone in the media who was talking about climate science wasn't a climate scientist on these TV shows where they need to talk about climate science. What the fuck is going on here? So I made this rap called I'm a Climate Scientist and just I kind of try to distill a whole bunch of climate science in a really funny kind of energizing rap, which kind of was released around the time of the disastrous Copenhagen Conference of Parties. But that went viral around climate science communities, that particular clip. So I thought, well, maybe there's something in this. Maybe we can give a space for climate. Yeah. So, you know, Rational Fear isn't all climate. You know, we talk about everything, but we always try to make space for climate. There's always something, a mention, a drive-by, a sketch or something, a home, a few minutes in every episode where we talk about climate.
I find this interesting because nowadays everyone's an expert. Actually, I put something up on LinkedIn yesterday. I said something like, you go to computer science school for 4 years, get a master's of software engineering, take two companies to ISO 9001 and build and sell multiple AI tools. And then someone, a coach or internet marketer sends you a DM to buy their $50 AI course. And it's happening everywhere. Does that drive you crazy as well? Like being someone who is actually doing something about it, how do you deal with the clickbaity stuff versus the real facts when you care so much about this stuff?
I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I've been thinking about kind of information and how we distill information and process information and how much information is out there and how anybody gets anything done and how anybody consumes anything and understands and distills an idea. And it's quite baffling that anything gets through to people at all, given where we are at in this information age. How I feel about it is, well, I'm starting to think I might be part of the problem. So I'm like, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't be doing a comedy podcast. Maybe comedy gets in the way of good information. But then comedy also explodes big ideas into people's brains that they might not have already thought of. So it's hard. it's a really tough kind of philosophical question you've posed there, Ronsley. On the podcast, I try to book good people who have the knowledge, who are like highly regarded, and or they are also people on the front lines telling their own personal story. You don't have to have a degree in climate scientists to talk about how bodies of your ancestors have been washed away from the cemetery in your island. You know, you don't need that. You just have to have the lived experience. So I'm kind of happy to talk to people who are, you know, on one end of the spectrum, extremely well scholarly, extremely well read, or are working at the front lines of technology and advancing technology to help climate. And at the other end, I'm willing to talk to people who are on the front lines of climate, who are dealing with climate every day.
I mean, it's about opening the conversation. And I feel like in general, we got into a stage right now where we don't open the conversation because we're scared of being refuted or our point of view not being accepted by everyone. We feel like it's got to be accepted by everything. We don't have this conversational area where we can think, refine our arguments. And by the way, when you were talking about a comedy getting in the way, The Daily Show has done a great job at, you know, educating people from a comedy standpoint. So has John Oliver and some others that are, you know, doing great work in education. I reached out to you primarily because I saw your work on the Vote Yes movement, and I am writing my second book on the ethical frameworks for artificial intelligence, primarily because if you look at the Australias, the Indias, the Americas, the Africas, where, you know, colonizers came and really destroyed ancient wisdom of collaboration, as opposed to say, like, you know, right now it is, I need to go faster so that I can leave my competition behind. I need to win so that they lose. And that was not always the case, because there was this ancient wisdom of collaboration. I belong to this land. This is not my piece of land where it all looks great, but my neighbors are not in that same thing. I would love for you to talk about, you know, the Vote Yes movement, how you see it, what made you get involved, and then we can then get in deeper into that conversation.
Look, I think a yes vote would have been incredible for Australia. It would have made Australia, for listeners who aren't from Australia, we're talking about a referendum in Australia where the constitution is going to be changed to recognise First Nations people in the constitution, which is great, easy. It was a two-part recognition. It was one, changing the constitution to put in the constitution the First Nations people were here first. The second part was essentially to set up a body called The Voice. So it was not only a symbolic gesture, but also a pragmatic gesture. So being symbolic is great. It's easy. It's easy to kind of have a mission statement, but it's where the rubber hits the road. And so this small body of between 20 to 60 people, depending on the model, was going to be set up to help give First Nations people an opportunity to give advice, non-binding advice to politicians of the day on issues that affect First Nations people. But Australians didn't get on board at all. So, you know, the beginning of last year, before the referendum, the recognition of First Nations people in the constitution was polling at about 68%. And as soon as the coalition decided that they're going to use it as a political wedge against the current government and jump out of bipartisanship, which it had been thought to have happened up until that stage, even in January, early as January, the coalition were making noises that this is going to be a bipartisan approach. They're going to get behind a yes vote. But then around March, something changed and Dutton came out, put his stake in the ground and said, you know what, we're going to run against this. And the same time as that happened, a whole big digital campaign for no appeared. It was funded by a strange group called the Atlas Foundation, the Atlas Group, based out of America, channeled through Advance Australia, which is a far right wing group in Australia. And they did this very slick anti-voice campaign. They rolled it out. Whereas Yes kind of was languishing. They were just relying on television commercials and ad campaigns and kind of corporate spend. They weren't really focused on the digital space much. They had a few kind of simple explainers, but weren't quite engaging. People didn't quite get it. As the months roll on, I saw that approval rating for The Voice tumble below 50%. And about 6 weeks out before The Voice, I got so annoyed that The Voice wasn't going great at all. And I felt very conflicted about jumping in, because for listeners, you can't tell but I'm not a First Nations person. I'm not a Black Australian. I can't really feel like it's my place to speak on behalf of First Nations people in Australia. But I had a good conversation with a couple of who were First Nations people. I put out a few feelers and pulled together a bunch of First Nations comedians and creators, as well as a bunch of other Yahoos. And we created like a small crack team of about eight who worked 3 days a week creating memes and videos and explainers. And we crowdfunded it through a platform called Raisely. We raised like $120,000 in a week, which is amazing. We got another $100,000 from a generous donor, plus Heaps Normal jumped in with $20,000 towards the end. So we could spend $20,000 more on Facebook than we could. For about $220,000, we ran this kind of campaign where we were creating funny explainers, funny videos, like ads. Like we were making our own ads. It was all unofficial. No one from Yes spoke to us. So it was a really fun sort of moment where people were saying to us, hey, your explainers and your content is far more useful than the other stuff. And also saying how a video might have changed their family's WhatsApp from no to yes and or something like that. So that was really heartening to know that we weren't making this in a vacuum, that people were sharing the content and pushing it out there and using the content as intended to have conversations about, yes, about constitutional recognition in a fun and funny way. And that was the aim. So it was just basically, hey, you know, now we've kind of got this bit of a track record of doing this. You know, it's like you want to communicate something that's going to kind of reach mass audiences. Just get the comedians involved. Just give us a budget. We'll go and make you content for weeks on end to have this conversation with everyone. And it's a campaign. It's a marathon. So we only had 6 weeks and Donny had $200,000. Yes, had a year and $35 million. No, probably had about the same. They spent about $8 million on Facebook, I think. But at the same time, the stuff we were making organically got seen, was being used, and we could promote other people as well. So we promoted the shit out of that Briggs video, which didn't need much help. But we put on our platforms and it did like 300,000 views, 400,000 views, and just on our platforms alone, which was great and amazing. You're so helpless and see what was happening was seeing people succumb to like lies by Advance Australia, like people kind of engaged in outright crazy lies. Awful, terrible.
Hey, it's Mick Hawes, host of The Toolshed. I love making my podcast, and that's primarily because Ronsley has helped me avoid a whole bunch of really basic mistakes that would have cost me a whole bunch of time, money, and energy. And Rons has compiled a list of these mistakes and how to avoid them, which is really a steal. You can get your copy where I downloaded mine at mistakes.wearepodcast.com. That is mistakes.wearepodcast.com. We Are Podcast. You can't find your voice if you don't use it.
What I really didn't like was that if you don't know, vote no, and that whole campaign.
Oh my God. Terrible.
That was crazy.
Terrible.
It's like you're promoting ignorance. And I'm an indoctrinated Australian. Before I became Australian, I had to prove that I could speak English three different times and go through this test when I wrote a thesis in English and I had two master's degrees. And it was fascinating how they did all that, but they did not educate me on the history of our land. And through Black Lives Matter, I spoke to a lot of Aboriginal elders that really broke my heart to really see how their families have been surviving and their ancestors and their grandparents and their parents were still, you know, they're probably the first generation that didn't belong to camps. It got me on this path where I realized that as someone who is a new Australian or someone that has been this interesting journey of being born in Bahrain and having Portuguese background and Indian heritage and living in Australia and seeing that, wait a minute, I was lucky in the sense that my name is Ronsley and not Venkatesh or something else. And people don't know what to expect when a Ronsley comes. All this happened when I would go in for an interview and someone would say, oh, you don't look like a Ronsley. And I didn't know what that even meant until a lot later on. There's really important work to be done right now, especially with artificial intelligence coming, because when you see AI right now, it's just in its infancy. It's learning from the data that is provided. And if the history that has been captured by, you know, colonial victors, then we have a problem. And we have a problem because we might not exist if AI continues with that kind of thinking. We won't have a chance to exist.
Definitely inbuilt bias to every technology that ever gets created. And if the white people are making the AI, that's the inbuilt bias that will pervade everywhere.
When you think about this collaborative effort, because it has to be collaborative, like as much as it hurts and, you know, as much as we'd love for someone to lose for us to win, we've got to like have a collaborative effort to make these ideas heard. Do you have some sort of a starting point that you can educate us on? I mean, comedy being something that lightens the idea or message that it probably gets to people. I mean, for us all trying to get our message across, however hard it might be to hear, is there a way that we can do that in a collaborative fashion?
That's a good point. On this particular issue, it's so important to be collaborative, to find people who do represent that particular point of view. Like, there's that great maxim, which is like, nothing about us without us. And that is so important. You've got to do this hand in hand with First Nations people. Like, FES, I was so happy that, you know, I had some great, prominent, funny Black comedians join us and academics join us on team so we could all do it together. And it was co-led by a wonderful creative director who I won't name. They could name themselves later because I don't think they'll get them in trouble. So, you know, it was just like, that was a real thrill to log on 3 days a week to have Zoom meetings with these folks and just kind of distill what they were saying into great bits of content and then like kind of do it, walk hand in hand, trying to do all this together. And that was a real thrill. And it was so great to go the week before we started the campaign to go to the Torres Strait with other great First Nations comedians and have them basically run Irrational Fear, run the podcast. And that was really a real joy to kind of set that platform up. We performed to like 60 people in a bowls club on Thursday Island and just spoke about First Nations kind of points of view on Australia. And that was amazing, very special. So yeah, I think people need to, when they think about collaboration, particularly when they're trying to represent any kind of group, nothing about us without us is a really great point to start. So don't even think about trying to speak from an area that isn't in your own experience without having someone with you to kind of help you, because that's just a cool, man. When you come into thinking about collaboration and storytelling like this, that is a great place to start.
What do you see your role now going forward? I couldn't even believe that we got there. I couldn't even believe the percentage of no to yes. And then I couldn't believe how divided we are. It almost felt like a repeat of Brexit. It felt exact, very similar, that everyone's like, oh, this is a no-brainer. And then it gets done and you're like, wait, what just happened? And then we could see that the division through COVID and vaccinations and, you know, lockdowns, and that happened all over social media where there were people who were friends for ages and disagreeing on these things and then decided that they won't be friends anymore because they had a differing viewpoint. How do we do this going forward? I'd love to get your thoughts on how you're seeing this and what, as Australians in particular, how can we actually do this better?
I think all ideas in 2023 are moot. I think it's what you're seeing with the atomization of media. It's going to become more and more impossible to kind of get new ideas, give new ideas life. So it is, I hate to say it, Rosalie. It's really difficult. And I don't have an answer. And I am burnt out. Like, I'm burnt out from this year. I haven't put out Irrational Fear since the referendum. We did the South by Southwest, but we got a show coming up in February, but I don't know how many podcasts I'm going to be publishing between now and February. Maybe I'm going to do one more next week for the podcast awards and put the survey out so I can find out what the listeners think, what they want to do. I'm genuinely burnt out from the year we've had. Maybe I've been burnt out for the last 4 years. Like, I've been working so hard on the podcast the last 4 years and just like, I honestly don't know. I think you need to talk to someone smarter than me is probably where I'd leave that one. I think as a nation, I'm really disappointed in the position we hold. I'm really disappointed in our traditional media for the continuing demonization of Aboriginal people. I'm really disappointed in the place that most Australians hold First Nations people. I'm disappointed in the education that Australians who aren't First Nations people have decided to kind of give themselves when it comes to First Nations people. It doesn't take much to do some reading, to do some learning, to do some listening. And once you kind of listen and kind of understand more about First Nations culture, you realize all of a sudden that First Nations culture, that is, and I underline is and bold is, that is Australia. And the Union Jack in the corner of our flag isn't, and I bold and underline that, Australia. Like, we have a country that is beholden by three other countries. Like, our economy is beholden by China. Our security is beholden by the United States. And then on paper, we are all of a sudden beholden to by King Charles, who became king by sitting on a rock and getting some magic oil put upon him. Like, that is wild. But the land we have a duty to as custodians, and the land that we're on, the people who have been taking custody of that for 60,000 years, they know what this country is about because they've been on that land. Folks just need to listen and understand that and get out of it. It's so hard to shake people's colonialist point of view. I don't know how to reach people beyond that. The colony, the idea of the colony is in people's heads, and that's who we are. We're just the colony. But we could be so much more, you know. We could be embracing culture in our land in a much more spiritual and magnificent way that elevates Australia to something else. And no one is, most of Australia is not willing to do that. And that is such a, I mean, that's just the sadness that I have to live with. I think one day it could be, you know, one day we could elevate ourselves. Like, oh, for me, this was like the first step. If The Voice won, it'd be the great first step to becoming a republic, you know, and then all of a sudden we are a different country. We are Australia. We're not a colony of England.
I find it crazy to say Commonwealth because there's nothing common about the wealth at all.
That is true. It is uncommonwealth. We are extremely wealthy because we have stolen all of it from other people. It's hard to explain to people the reason they have their house and their pool and their life and their family and every dollar they've ever earned. The reason why we have the Opera House or the Harbour Bridge or the skyscrapers in Melbourne or the vineyards in Adelaide. It's because we have sucked out the value of this country from the land of the people who were looking after it. And every time you fly over Australia and look down Australia, you should see the farms and the houses and wonder whose land that was before there was a farm and a house there. And before there was, you know, whatever that was before then, because that's the land we're on. And there were people looking after that land beforehand. And we have to, people are so uncomfortable with the truth that Australia was founded on genocide. And once people accept that truth and realize that, oh, we are privileged to live on this world, we live on this land and have the lives we have, and there's a reason for that privilege. And it is the most uncomfortable truth there is. We can now move forward and do something better. And that's what that was about. All people who are immigrants to Australia, well, they don't realize they're accepted in an economic system that favored them over Aboriginal people as well. So they too are privileged. It's very difficult for people to understand that or people to acknowledge that. I don't know how to fix that. The only way to fix that is like to change curriculum in the earliest of education periods from primary school to high school and get people understand. It'll take like several generations to truly remove colonialism from the curriculum to explain the uncomfortable truths about Australia to generations of kids. And then once those kids are in a position of leadership, then we can change.
When I was learning to be a chef, one of my head chefs said something to me while we were cutting 25 kilos of cabbage. And he said, Ronsley, if you're trying to solve something that can be solved in your lifetime, then you're thinking too small. And you know, the talk about this, the more I feel like there's something way bigger here at play. And I find it absolutely insane that we celebrate the genocide with statues and Australia Day and all these kind of things that even what just went by with the poppies and, you know, Remembrance Day, it's like there's a lot that happened that, you know, we are sweeping under the rug that we should take responsibility for, everyone included, you know, immigrants like myself, colonials and Aboriginal Australians. And I find that even just starting the conversation and having this conversation has been huge. It has been eye-opening for me. I know that you feel burnt out, but I want you to know that the work that you've done has opened other people's eyes in some way and shape, and you don't know where that could lead us. And I want to thank you for all the stuff you've done, because, you know, it's hard to stand up when you're outnumbered. It's hard to stand up when you don't know whether it's your voice to even, or your movement to even have a voice in. So thank you, Dan, for doing all that.
Figuring out what to do, and far out. It was, I wanted to do something in January, you know, but I was like, it's not mine. This is, I'm not going to be the white guy that takes this issue. So I waited, and then I decided to be the white guy that took the issue.
No, I think you did a great work. You did great work, and thank you for doing it, because you don't, I feel like there's multiple smaller movements that I've started because of that education, including it affecting me to a great extent. So
great. Hopefully, you know, folks can jump on board. I got to meet some folks from the Desi for Yes group last week, and they were talking to me how much our work was received in their channels. And I thought, that's how awesome is that? Then the FES stuff was being put through other cultures' prisms and shared and well received. So that was really cool. So hopefully, it would have been smarter to kind of start in January rather than 6 weeks out, but you know, it was difficult.
Mate, the hindsight's always 20/20. You can only do what you can and what you've done so far. Ladies and gentlemen, Irrational Fear, go find that podcast. Also, links to Dan Illick will be in the show notes. Dan, this was a little slice of heaven. Thank you so much for joining me on the show.
A little slice of heaven. Me equivocating and wrestling with moral quandaries was a little slice of heaven. Well, you know, when I go to heaven, hopefully it's a lot easier than this podcast.
No, the conversation was important to have. And I think that was for me a little slice of heaven. So thank you.
Thank you so much. It's very generous of you.
Thank you so much for listening. Listen to the back catalog of over 300 episodes by going to wearepodcast.com. If you're looking for something specific, let the We Are Podcast team point you in the right direction. Send us an email on podcast@wearepodcast.com. Also, if you know a business owner who has a podcast, ask them to listen. Share an episode with them. The conversations here are going to save them lots of trial, error, time, and money. Until next week, much love.